John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we've got an hour-long look at a somber week on this first Friday of May. But we will note a big drop in the U.S. unemployment rate in April. Some really good news there, even for the long-term unemployed. We'll have some reminders of stories we think you haven't heard enough about. We'll talk about the crisis in Ukraine the world can't get away from. And we note the landmark tragedy this week in the state of Oklahoma that may have changed forever the way we think about execution by lethal injection. But first, this sad story out of Nigeria. Hundreds of girls. The government can't even nail down a figure of kidnapped schoolgirls. The number ranges from 150 to perhaps 300. This story of terrorism and chaos in Nigeria has been hard to follow in the noise of everything else going on in the world.
Breaking news tonight, a Malaysia Airlines plane carrying 239 people bound for Beijing is missing.
Government officials still piecing together information.
Families of the missing passengers shouting out as they meet with South Korea's president and learn the horrifying details of how the disaster unfolded.
But it wasn't always thus. In the 1970s, Nigeria's troubles were the focus of the world's attention. A civil war in Nigeria, what some call the Biafran conflict.
At 40 minutes past 4 p.m. today, Nigerian time, Africa's worst war came to an end, that between Nigeria and breakaway Biafra. Major General Philip F. Yang, left in charge of Biafra when General Ojukwu fled Sunday, announced the end on Radio Biafra, a mobile radio station.
The aftermath of this conflict in the 1970s has defined Nigeria and its instability in our time.
We have fought a long, bitter battle, and it has ended in a victory for common sense, victory for the unity of this country.
Nigerian General Yakubu Gowon in 1970. The terrified and angered parents of the kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria today, the government officials and their equivocal statements about the crisis, even the kidnapper leaders of the terrorist group Boko Haram, were all born into or came of age in the aftermath of the civil war that the whole world watched in Nigeria. But the world has seemingly turned away from Nigeria in this crisis, and it's something that has saddened and angered Nigerian writer and novelist Oke Ndibe. He's a visiting professor of African studies at Brown University. To be Nigerian today, Ndibe says, is a tragedy both peculiar and absurd.
Nigeria has become a country where the lives of the citizens don't seem to count, especially to government officials who proceed day after day with what I call the business of stealing the nation blind, even as hundreds and sometimes thousands of citizens die in senseless attacks by terrorist group.
If you can't protect your citizens, if you can't protect girls in schools, then have you lost your legitimacy as a government?
The Nigerian government actually has never, in the 52-53-year history of the country, Nigerians have never been lucky in the Department of Leadership. As Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist, famously said, Nigeria is a country that has found a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. And so you have a country which has every reason and has all the talent and all the resources to achieve greatness. But somehow we continue to have mediocrity at the hem of the country's affairs. And so the country ends up in a rather terrible and unfortunate and tragic place.
Talk about your reaction to the headlines that we've all read around the world, the uncertainty over the numbers of the girls abducted, the lack of statements on the part of the government of what's actually going on to get their release. What are you hearing and how do you respond?
Well, my response is one of outrage. The fact that Nigerian officials can't even give us a count of the number of students who were abducted. How do you even know that you found them when you don't know how many are missing? And there's this old joke in Nigeria about a football coach who was asked how his team was going to win a game. And he said, we're going to fumble our way to victory. And so it seems to me that that's the same ethos that drives Nigerian affairs, that its leaders They believe that somehow we're going to fumble our way to greatness.
Just looking at the landscape over the last few weeks, we've had a global hunt for a Malaysian airplane at the bottom of the sea. We've seen the minute-by-minute unfolding of the rescue and then unfortunate discovery of bodies in that South Korean ferry. And yet this Nigerian story is unfolding so differently. What does that say to you?
What it says to me is that there is a certain fatigue around the world about Nigeria, because this senselessness, this sense of tragedy has been so unremitting and has gone on for so long, in fact, for many years, that I think that after a while, the world sort of tunes out. And it's as if the rest of the world has said to Nigeria, you just figure out your mess, your tragedy. But it's unfortunate, because ultimately it is the most vulnerable children who suffer in Nigeria. And there's a lot of suffering going on. Meanwhile, the people who are so-called leaders in the country continue to live it up. They continue to buy private jets and to travel and buy mansions around the world. And the tragedy has to stop. In the end, the reason that everybody in the world ought to be interested about the Nigerian tragedy is that unless the U.S. and Europe and Britain and other African countries wake up and in a sense help to address this tragedy in progress in the country, it's going to spread and it's going to come to our doorsteps sooner or later.
What could your government do that would reassure you? What would you love to hear? Statements, actions?
The Nigerian government is good at giving speeches, giving press releases that assure the citizens to go out about their business. But we know that Nigeria has become, for a long time, a very abnormal location. And so what I'd like the government to do is to come up with a plan to combat the threat of Boko Haram. For example, it should be easy if the government used half a brain to infiltrate this group and then to undermine the activities of the group from within. It should be easy to acquire some surveillance technology that should be able to protect the most vulnerable locations that these terrorists attack. And then it should be possible to deploy the police and the military to guard institutions, especially, you know, school children have been slaughtered, you know, in their hundreds and thousands. It should be possible for the Nigerian government to roll out, not assure us anymore, because the assurances amount to very little or nothing. I want to see them take action, and I want to begin to see results.
If you were writing a story from the perspective of a young girl, school child in Abuja or Lagos or anywhere in Nigeria, what questions would that character in your novel or your story ask?
Well, the character in my novel, a vulnerable young character, would have a sense, be besieged, if you like, by a sense of the tragic. And this character will be wondering, why is it there's so much promise around me that I have talent that I want to unleash, but I am born in a country that continues to repress and to suppress and to deny me the opportunities to express myself fully.
Okay, and Ndibe is a visiting professor of African Studies at Brown University. His new novel, Foreign Gods Incorporated, was published in January. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We want to announce a takeaway project now we think will be of interest to writers, authors, and readers everywhere. Books are the original social network platform, right? Open a book and you log into a shared experience. It's why there are book clubs. You're in one, I'll bet. Great people talking about books, suggesting ideas, talking about relationships, great characters, great history. Well, the takeaway wants you. We want to invite all of the great book clubs out there into one big tent this summer. We want your book club to take part and help us design the way we do books here on the program. We're going to start things off with a reading list, not final, from our own literary critic and takeaway producer, Mithili Rao. So, Mithili, what we're trying to do here is capture the kitchen table experience of real book clubs, right?
Yeah, I had the great chance to be a guest of honor at my mother's book club last year. And, you know, when people talk about books, these are people I've known for a long time. But talking about books allows for a different kind of conversation. And as I've been telling people that the Takeaway is doing this summer, I'm getting stories about the unique book clubs that people wind up in. A friend who's a TV producer, she's in a book club with all her father's Wall Street friends. She was invited to it. So it's her and all these 50 or 60-year-old men talking about books. And she wouldn't be hanging out with them otherwise, but her dad said, you should join my book club. And that's this unique connection and conversation that they get to have now.
All right. So what are we thinking of in terms of the kinds of books that might work for this? And again, this isn't the final list. What are you thinking?
I really wanted to look for authors who are young, who are new, who are writing about the American experience, themes about family, about intimacy, about unlikely relationships that really take a hold of people.
Character-driven, lifestyle, Americana. It's not a genre exactly. What titles did you come up with here?
A lot of readers may be familiar with Karen Russell.
Sure.
She is author of Swamplandia, which was a Times bestseller. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer. Her new book is called Sleep Donation. And it kind of imagines this dystopian future where the country suffers an insomnia epidemic.
Put it on my list immediately. Yeah. Very good. All right, dystopia. Got to get dystopia in there. What else?
Another book I'm looking at for this summer is Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. He's also the author of And Then We Came to the End. Mm-hmm. His new book kind of looks at themes of the feeling that the walls are crumbling around you. It has a character who realizes that someone has come up with a website, a Facebook page, and a Twitter account, all impersonating him. Also out later this summer is a debut novel from Emily Gould. She was the editor of Gawker, and people might remember her for blogging a lot about her personal life. But her book is about a friendship between two girls in their 20s and 30s and the sort of intense bond that they form and how they kind of navigate these incredible changes of this time of their life together.
You know, there's one author that interests me, Dinah Mengistu, whose book All Our Names is actually the first title since he won the MacArthur.
Yeah, no, that book just came out recently to a lot of acclaim. He was also on the New Yorker's 20 Under 40 list. And it's, again, a story about American relationships. There's a love affair between an American woman and an African man in the 70s. And also some political tensions.
That sounds like a great selection. But this isn't a final list. We're
Correct.
Still sort of working it up.
Correct. And as people submit their own book clubs and nominate their book clubs and tell us why we should spotlight their discussions this summer, if they have book suggestions, too, we want to hear them. I mean, this is still a work in progress, so we want to know.
We are collaborating with our listeners out there. We know you have voices in your own book club that would be great to hear on the radio. You get an opportunity to discuss on the air. And we can actually add to your book club because we've got all our listeners who are fantastic readers, have all kinds of things to say as you hear every day on the program.
We're really excited about it. So go to thetakeaway.org and tell us about your book club. Tell us where you are. Tell us who's in your book club, the kinds of books that you are passionate about. And one of our producers will be in touch with you and we'll be assembling our collection of book clubs for the summer.
And now you have to go back to your stack of books on your desk.
I do. It's waiting for me. It will consume me.
Literary critic and Takeaway producer Maithili Rao, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
You're going to want to stay updated on our book club series, so all you have to do is text the word book club to 69866. Again, that's book club, all one word, to 69866.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's looking more and more like eastern Ukraine is becoming a breakaway territory in a crisis that seems to be going Moscow's way right now. First, the shooting. Two Ukrainian helicopters reportedly shot down. Officials in Kiev say by pro-Russian separatists. Ukraine also says it has launched an assault on the rebel stronghold of Slovyansk, a city reportedly surrounded now. And Ukraine has reinstated the draft for men aged 18 to 24. Meanwhile, Moscow taunts the Ukrainian government with suggestions that all hope may be lost for any kind of negotiated settlement, and huge May Day celebrations in Moscow this week, the largest since Soviet times, suggesting that this may be a good moment to be pro-Russian, a message not lost on the people in eastern Ukraine. Joining us now is Stephen Nix, who follows the Ukraine crisis as a regional program director at the nonpartisan International Republican Institute based in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just say right off the bat, the chairman of the board of the IRA is Senator John McCain, and he's been a real activist on Ukraine, encouraging a much stronger confrontation with Russia's Vladimir Putin. Does the IRA take that same position in its approach to Ukraine right now?
Well, IRI is a democracy promotion organization. We work primarily with political parties in most of the former Soviet republics. So our mission really is to promote democracy by building strong, multiple-party, multidimensional political and electoral systems. Senator McCain has been a strong advocate of Ukraine, one of the strongest in our Congress. He has advocated for greater sanctions against Russia for its involvement. He's also advocated arming the Ukraine armed forces as a deterrent to Russian aggression.
So what are the challenges for Ukraine right now? And I want to talk about the various factions. You'll be responsible at IRI for the, at least in part, some election monitoring that's going to be taking place in the next few weeks.
Yes. Well, with regard to the elections, they're scheduled for May 25th. There will be presidential elections as well as mayoral elections in certain cities. There are a number of issues related to the elections. The government of Ukraine, the interim government, is trying very hard to put in place the mechanics of an election that will be free, fair, transparent, and meets international standards. The challenge is, at least in some of the far eastern oblasts, we predict that there are elements, both external and internal, that will attempt to incite, to provoke, to create disturbances in an effort to discredit these elections. And I think that's what IRI will be watching for. I think that's what one of the many organizations that will be observing, the OSCE, other international organizations, have to be very, very wary of and be on guard and look for this.
Well, let's drill into that a little bit. I mean, there are a lot of people with a stake in having these elections be a fiasco, from Moscow all the way to the border of Poland.
Well, I would say that there's a very small portion of Ukrainians who would like to see these elections not be accredited and not be recognized as free and fair. We all recognize that there are certain divisions within Ukraine. However, these divisions have been exaggerated and overblown by the Kremlin propaganda machine. IRI does a lot of national polling in Ukraine. We've conducted surveys as recently as April. We did another one in March. And our data totally refutes the Kremlin line that large majorities of eastern Ukrainians and Ukrainians as a nation want to see some sort of Russian intervention or feel that they need protection from Russia based on their ethnicity or language. We asked the question of people, do you think that a Russian military intervention is necessary to protect Ukrainians? And an overwhelming number, 85%, say that such intervention is not necessary. Similarly, when asked if Ukraine should remain a unitary, territorial, secure state, overwhelmingly, over 73% stated that they wanted Ukraine to remain intact as a nation and don't want federalization as promoted by Moscow and do not want their country to be divided.
Talking with Stephen Nix, who's Regional Program Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute. Can you comment, and what do your polls say, if anything, on the allegations from Moscow and elsewhere that among the factions inside Ukraine are a lot of anti-Semitic groups, right-wing groups, and groups that Vladimir Putin has used to discredit the whole humanitarian face of the Ukrainian regime right now?
Well, if it were not so serious, these allegations would be laughable. All one has to do is monitor Russian television. There, Ukraine is portrayed as a failed state, that there's chaos in the capital, that people in Kiev are going hungry, that this government cannot manage the government's affairs, and it's absolutely false and totally refuted by people like myself who travel to Kiev regularly, meet with government leaders, see that they're a functional government, trying to do their best to get through these elections and undertake urgently needed reforms after the disaster of the Yanukovych regime. This is very, very much a part of the Kremlin line. And you've got a very practiced liar in Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, who is, to my dismay and others, is demanding that Ukraine recognize the rights of people in eastern Ukraine, these protesters, to exercise their right of free expression, First Amendment rights, what have you, when at the same time in his own country, if one were to try to engage in any sort of political protest, even to hold up a sign in Red Square, that person would be jailed and fined. So it's incredible to me that Russia is making these demands of Ukraine when these same things are not practiced in their own country.
Stephen Nix is the Regional Program Director for Eurasia at the International Republican Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour on The Takeaway, how the troubled execution in Oklahoma may have changed the debate in the U.S. on the death penalty.
Hi, my name is Justin Valenzuela. Death is by no means an answer to seeking justice or vengeance. We as humans really seek a closure, not really found through any sort of execution in any form. And really, vengeance really leaves you just with a sense of jadedness.
Hi, my name is Darrell Willis, and I'm calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. The ending of a human life must only be defensive, never punitive. No person has the right to end another life except in direct defense of themselves, their property, or another person. The death penalty has no place in a civilized society.
Gloria from Portland, Oregon writes to us, the state should not be in the business of killing people except in a justifiable war. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. Here's a question. Why is there a doctor in the prison death house? We will ask a doctor later this hour on The Takeaway. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us now. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So we just heard our colleague at IRI describe how Senator John McCain has taken a very activist role, as you well know, on the Ukraine crisis and confronting Vladimir Putin. How does the rest of that debate play out on Capitol Hill right now?
Yeah, McCain's not alone, but let's listen to him in his own words this week, appearing with a whole bunch of Republicans in the Senate asking for much tougher sanctions on Russia and Vladimir Putin. Listen.
And we are not accusing the administration of doing nothing. What we are saying that nothing they are doing is in any way a break on Vladimir Putin's behavior. And for us to refuse to even give them defensive weapons is an outrage. It's a scandal.
I mean, the real question is what's going to move the needle here? You've got these huge May Day parades in Moscow. There's no sense from Moscow that they're feeling any pain.
One of the things that's complicating American efforts here, John, is a lack of coordination with Europe. The European countries, of course, rely on Russian gas. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in the White House today, speaking with President Obama, presumably about just that issue, trying to get more coordination so that sanctions can be ratcheted up. If we're doing one thing and the Europeans are doing another, they're just not effective. And that's part of the concern. She also met with several Republican senators last night for dinner.
What's the ratchet up situation here? I mean, if you look at the Russian economy, the ruble's doing just fine. I mean, maybe there's an oligarch somewhere who's having a bad day, but he certainly hasn't come into the public.
And that's what McCain and his friends are talking about, is increasing the cost for Putin should he decide to proceed with an incursion into Ukraine to basically make the cost-benefit shift towards more cost.
So if you're looking for a pain from this situation outside of Ukraine, where obviously there are dreadful situations happening there as the fighting begins to escalate and there's this surrounding of the city of Slovyansk, you'd have to leave Earth entirely.
Yeah, John, you know, it's interesting. American and Russian space officials have both been concerned that the increasing tensions were going to lead to an inability for them to cooperate. And indeed, American space officials were forced to announce a suspension of a lot of cooperation with Russians, although this International Space Station efforts were specifically exempt. And this has led to a lot of questions on Capitol Hill this week about what exactly happens if things get really bad. It's sort of a Hollywood movie scenario. Things get really bad between the Americans and the Russians. We rely on them for transportation to the space station and back. Listen to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin this week talking sort of about what'll happen if Americans don't back off.
We have warned our American friends that we will answer declarations with declarations and actions with actions. They say, don't touch the International Space Station in these programs. Okay, then let's do it like this. If they want to hit the economic potential of Russian space engineering, they should use a trampoline to deliver their astronauts to the International Space Station.
Noting that we are dependent on the Russians for a reentry vehicle because we don't have a space shuttle anymore.
And to get there, John, Americans have relied on Soyuz rockets for 11 launches to the ISS over the last 11 years, and we rely on Soyuz to get back. Senators had questions for NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. What happens if things get bad and Americans are stranded on the space station? Listen to Bolden.
Everybody talks about the Russians stranding us. The Soyuz is a three-person crew, three-person spacecraft, and at least two of those people are essential, and okay. Usually one of those two essential people is the flight engineer who's an American astronaut.
Well, at least you hear there, John, NASA officials assuring senators that the Russians won't strand American astronauts aboard the space station if tensions rise to the point where Americans and Russians don't cooperate at all.
Very reassuring. Any positive flag waving there on Capitol Hill from the 6.3% unemployment rate? That's positive news.
Of course, and the biggest drop in the unemployment rate in 5 years, although hundreds of thousands of Americans who've left the workforce, which puts a damper on some of that good news as well. You have to keep in mind that a lot of people aren't looking for work anymore, but certainly the numbers are good.
Forget the silver lining. There are plenty of people on Capitol Hill who will do that. Have a great weekend, Todd.
Thanks, John. You too.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We interrupt our normal Friday movie segment to bring you a commercial for The Amazing Spider-Man. You know, why not join the bandwagon? Everyone else has, right?
Join in, John.
Exactly.
You can't beat him.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast and the Sporkful podcast. You're a producer for that as well.
Yeah, I'm working on that these days as well.
So what can we say about The Amazing Spider-Man aside from the fact that it is ubiquitous, Kristen?
Well, we can say that this is the fifth Spider-Man film in about a dozen years, so that's a lot of Spider-Man. And this is part of the second movie in the reboot starring Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone.
Love him.
Yeah, everyone loved him in The Social Network, right? But this does have a slightly different mood than the original ones. And the most recent one here is pretty big, very packed, three villains, 2.5 hours.
I love one of the villains, Electro.
I can see that. I can see you don't want to be here. I can see you're scared. I can see you don't know what's happening to you. I can see that you don't want to hurt anybody. It's going to be all right.
Got a clear shot. Standing by.
I don't want them shooting me.
I'm not going to shoot you. You guys, this is my buddy Max. I told you about Max. No one shoots at Max.
Rafer Guzman, you know, that's the intrigue about Spider-Man. You don't know who's a good guy or a bad guy. That's sort of the deal. How does this work for you?
I guess that's true. You know, we've had about 15 years of superhero movies now, right? And it seems like there are two kinds to me. There are the serious kind, like The Dark Knight, that are addressing real-world issues. Then you've got the cheeky, jokey, funny kind, like maybe Thor and Iron Man, for sure. And I just feel like Spider-Man just walks this really safe line right down the middle. All it really wants to give you is a guy in a spandex suit knocking around the weird-looking villains. It doesn't want to do anything more than that, and I find it a little boring. I find this kind of safe, irrelevant ground that's staked out just really tiresome. After all these superhero movies, this is all it has to offer.
So it needs more jokes or more advocacy of environmental concerns?
Well, I mean,
to be meaningful
for you? even in the recent Avengers movie, we tackled Snowden and the NSA say a little bit. There was some nod to some wider concern. And although I do like Andrew Garfield, he's not Robert Downey Jr. He's not as charismatic as he is.
Yeah, and No one can be.
No one can be. He's not even Hemsworth from Thor. And I just don't feel like
you're as charismatic.
I'm almost as big as him.
Almost, yeah.
I don't find him that compelling. That's my problem.
I'm hammering Rafer on this social concern, meaning for Spider-Man thing. What do you think?
I have to disagree with you, Rafer. I don't think a superhero needs to have a social agenda or a bigger message. What I loved about the original Spider-Man movies that came out with Tobey Maguire, they were just good fun. They just embraced the fact that they were going to have a good time. They joked around. And I do wish that this reboot joked around more. This one jokes around more than the first one. I will say that. The first one was pretty, I'm very depressed and I'm a sullen teenager. This one has a little bit more fun.
All right. Here's a legitimate question, a literary question. Can the Victorian era be good fun? The movie Belle.
These are the keys of the house. They have hung at the waist of your aunt for the last 30 years.
I am not Lady Mary. I am not an unwanted maid.
Lady Mary is too old to continue in charge of the house. You may take up your duties on your return.
Are you punishing me?
Now, this Lady Mary bears no relationship to the Downton Abbey Lady Mary.
No.
How does this work for you?
Not at all. I have got to say, this is the best movie I've seen all year. I just loved this movie. This is telling the story, a real story from the 1700s in England, of a woman who is half black, half white, raised with her white aristocracy family, how she deals with courtship when she has a lot of money, but she has the mixed race background during this time. It's a little bit Jane Austen. It's a lot of history. There's the
slavery good fun. I don't know.
It was fantastic.
Really?
It was really great. I highly recommend it.
As somber as 12 Years a Slave or something fundamentally different?
Totally fundamentally different. It's like a romance with some history and a lot of beautiful costumes.
More Austen than 12 Years?
It's been compared quite a bit to Jane Austen, actually, by a lot of people. And there is that component there of finding the right suitable match.
All right, the movie Belle there, and heading into the weekend, what's on the podcast?
This week we are talking with a real comic book geek who loves Spider-Man to get his take. Maybe he'll feel a little bit differently about the movie than Rafer.
I suspect he'll love it. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They both are host and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
Only you can make all this world seem right.
So it all comes down to one guy. The billions lost in the 2009 recession and financial meltdown. All of those underwater homeowners, people who lost their homes and jobs since 2009. And we're not even out of it as the unemployment rate creeps down to 6.3%. One bank executive, only one, is serving time for the cooked numbers that lay behind the financial crisis of 2009. It's a mystery senior reporter Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica decided to get to the bottom of, literally, why only one top banker went to jail for the financial crisis is the title of his piece in this week's New York Times Magazine. Jesse, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell me about this defendant in Pennsylvania who on some level is the symbol of everything that went wrong in the economy and everything that went wrong in the investigations to try to hold people accountable after the financial meltdown.
Yes, they got the guy who caused the crisis.
Yes.
His name is Karim Sarageldin. He is an Egyptian-born investment banker, was an investment banker for Credit Suisse. He was four rungs below the CEO, and he was in charge of traders who traded complex mortgage securities.
And he is guilty.
He's guilty.
Yeah.
There's no question.
What did he do?
I don't want to minimize his guilt, and he doesn't minimize his guilt. He oversaw a team that lied about the values of their assets. And at one crucial moment, they sought a fake deal with another bank to preserve the value of their mortgage-backed securities as if they were willing to purchase at a higher price. Now, the question is, did anybody else do this?
Well, you described that the judge in the sentencing of Mr. Sarageldin actually has some soul-searching moments on that precise issue. Who else did worse? That sort of thing.
Yes. It was an amazing moment to see Hellerstein, judge's district judge down in Manhattan, struggle with this. And he said there was an evil climate, not just at your bank, but at all the other banks. And it was clear to him. And yet he was presented with this one defendant and had to do what he needs to do, sentence Karim. And that's proper. But he was baffled by this state of affairs.
And you're baffled why Karim is the one banker sitting in jail from the mortgage-backed securities sell-off meltdown crisis of 2009.
I think that none of us could possibly fathom this. This is not justice. Either Karim is not guilty or somebody else somewhere, especially somewhere higher up in the firmament of corporate America, had to have been guilty. And so I set out to try to figure out how this could possibly have happened, that they didn't get anyone else.
And if you're an archaeologist, you look at the sort of legal record of financial debacles going back to the 1980s, and you see prosecutions in the savings and loan case. You see prosecutions of Arthur Andersen. The company actually went out of business. You see prosecutions and guilty verdicts for Enron. And then all of a sudden, boom, you drop off the edge and there's nothing.
Right. The greatest calamity since the Great Depression, and we've got nothing.
Who changed? Did the Justice Department change strategy? Did the lawyers graduate from a different school all of a sudden?
Yeah. So my argument is that over the decade after the successful prosecutions of Enron, WorldCom, et cetera, the Department of Justice suffered a series of fiascos, self-imposed changes in their rules. They shot themselves in the foot. They overreached. They had bad rulings from the courts. And this all added up to two things. One, an erosion of their skill set and an inability to investigate. And then also a change in culture where they just started running scared.
Let's talk about the expertise. Basically, you say that the Justice Department lawyers are really good at compelling settlements but not terribly good at mounting prosecutions that are going to end up in court.
Yes. After Arthur Andersen. Arthur Andersen is the big accounting firm that enables Enron. The DOJ indicts them. Arthur Andersen goes out of business, and then eventually the Supreme Court throws out the ruling, and the Department of Justice considers this a terrible black eye.
Don't go down there again.
And they don't want to do that. I think they overlearned the lesson there. And then what happens is they start to shift to settlements. Deferred prosecutions, non-prosecutions, and settlements. And the settlement culture completely erodes their investigative ability. If you're going into it with a sense that you're going to settle with the corporation, the main thing that you don't do is investigate thoroughly the individuals, especially the individuals at the highest echelons of corporate America, to try to figure out whether they committed a crime.
The irony here is that in the beginning, during the Bush era, the notion was we're not going to give companies the impression that this is a kind of license for doing bad things, paying these settlements. But that's exactly where we are today.
Yes. I mean, I think that a lot of the irony here is that their own ambitions in the Department of Justice have been turned on them and undone their abilities to actually successfully prosecute people and corporations. And so what happened was they wanted to, you know, the early Bush administration Department of Justice, ironically,
they were tough.
They were very tough. They prosecuted one of George Bush's closest political allies in Ken Lay at Enron.
And now the Justice Department fears that by going after companies, they're actually reducing people's jobs, which is politically sensitive. And by aggressively prosecuting, they get tarred with the idea that you're denying people access to lawyers, that suddenly the Department of Justice in seeking justice is anti-democratic. That's where we are today.
Yes. So what happened was in the another fiasco after Arthur Andersen was the KPMG investigation into tax fraud in the Southern District, and they overreached and supposedly violated the constitutional rights of the individuals by depriving them of the attorneys paid for by KPMG. Some prosecutors consider this hush money from the corporation, but the judge said, no, you can't make the company stop paying those fees. And that's one significant ruling that really has rolled back a series of tools that prosecutors used to use to pierce the corporate veil to get corporations to prosecute corporations and, more importantly, I think, prosecute the individuals at corporations who are committing crimes.
Jesse Eisinger is senior reporter for ProPublica and author of Why Only One Top Banker Went to Jail for the Financial Crisis in this week's New York Times Magazine. Jesse, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll explore the meaning of the death penalty. One of you in Oregon says, there are many that should be put down because of my own vengeance, but it costs so much to keep them alive. I'm on the fence. Justice or vengeance? What do you think about the death penalty? 8778-MY-TAKE. That's our number. You can go to thetakeaway.org to join the conversation. The sound of an execution gone wrong.
Why don't you shut it down? He's still alive. You want me to shut down while he's still alive?
That macabre scene is from the movie The Green Mile, a fictional debacle for a man in the once thought to be humane electric chair. The debacle that played out in Oklahoma this week was not fiction, though. A lethal injection gone wrong. A doctor standing by, stopping it. Prison officials pulling a curtain to shield the witnesses from a body convulsing and dying of a drug-induced heart attack. This was the real-life scene for the now-dead death row convict, Clayton Lockhart. The drug cocktail used was obtained from a compounding pharmacy. The recipe, protected by secrecy rules enacted in Oklahoma, as death penalty states try to secure a reliable supply of lethal injection drugs in response to a diminishing world supply. The Oklahoma Corrections Director has since called for an indefinite stay of executions in that state while an investigation goes on. Dr. Mark Stern joins us now. He's a former Assistant Secretary for Healthcare at the Washington State Department of Corrections. Dr. Stern, why do doctors stand by in lethal injection executions?
They may be there to assist with the execution, and if they're just standing by, John, it may be to declare death.
And in your experience, is that something you might have been called to do in Washington State?
Well, I was called to do that. I was called to make sure that the gurney was in working condition. That was a policy that was in place a couple of years prior to an execution that we had. And then we were also called upon to provide the medications that were used for the lethal injection.
And in your personal case, that was a conflict of principles and forced you to make a decision.
Definitely. There are a few ethical principles that physicians operate under. Three of them are beneficence, non-malevolence, and patient autonomy, which simply means do good, don't do bad, and be guided by the patient's wishes. And assisting in any way at an execution violates all three of those ethical principles.
And so you resigned?
I did.
Now, didn't you know that this job might entail that when you began as Assistant Secretary for Healthcare at the Washington State Department of Corrections?
John, that's an excellent question. And actually, it was not on my radar. What was on my radar at the time I interviewed for the position was how serious was the department about helping me provide safe healthcare for patients, keeping their blood sugars down if they were diabetic and their blood pressures down if they had hypertension. I just was not thinking about the execution process. That wasn't something that we learn about in medical school.
Let's talk about a doctor who would be administering a cocktail that he might not even know what is in it in one of these states where the secrecy laws have been enacted. How can a doctor do something like that when the definition of failure is that the patient lives?
The doctor should not be involved. Unfortunately, John, an execution relies on medical technology, but it is not a medical procedure. And for the ethical reasons I mentioned a moment ago, no medical person, doctor, nurse, or other healthcare practitioner should be involved in the execution. So the issue that you raised shouldn't come up because we should not be around. We should not even be there at the moment of death or presumed death to declare death, because even the simple act of saying the person is dead raises an ethical conundrum. If they are dead, that's okay, but imagine the situation where they're not. The logical conclusion of my statement to the executioner of he's not yet dead is to hit him again with the execution the medications. And so that, again, would put me in an ethical bind.
All right. Let's talk philosophically a little more here before we get down to brass tacks a little bit. Is it possible for you to have this problem ethically but still be in support of the death penalty as a legal principle, as an appropriate penalty for certain crimes, Dr. Stern?
Sure. Good question also, John. So we're all guided by three lights, a moral light, an ethical light, and a legal light. And so those three can be out of sync. And in fact, they were for me. My moral position at the time on executions was not necessarily aligned with the ethical position. But we don't, as physicians, get to choose our ethics. Those are determined by our profession, by our colleagues. And when they are misaligned, then you are bound by the ethical obligations, also the legal obligations. And if you're in a position where they're misaligned and you can't deal with the misalignment, you have to recuse yourself.
But aren't doctors, isn't there a role of doctors as a kind of impartial arbiter of these, threshold moments in health, life, death, to have a doctor there when you pass from life? Isn't that something that is appropriate, even if the situation is an execution. You'd rather have a doctor there than a bunch of ghoulish uniformed cops putting tubes in your arm, right?
So there's two answers to that, John. The first is that physicians aren't at every situation life change. If you go to the drugstore and buy drugs, your doctor isn't there. But the second answer is if a patient were to request my assistance, my presence at their execution as their physician to support them, for example, if a mental health professional were there to support the patient, to give them counsel, to hold their hand, I would have no problem with that because that's consistent with our ethical obligations. But the moment the doctor or the health professional changes their behavior and becomes supportive to the execution, they have crossed the line. So being there to support them in that transition would be fine.
In our final moments here, I don't want to malign the doctor in Oklahoma who was there and had a very difficult decision to make. But what are your thoughts about what happened in Oklahoma this week before we go?
Briefly, he had a very easy decision to make. His decision was when he was asked to participate to say no. Once he got into the middle of that situation, clearly, had this been a medical procedure, there would have been other appropriate support present. For example, if an intravenous is put in during an operation and the intravenous fails, you try somewhere else, you bring a surgeon in and look for a different point of access. So all of those proper things that should have been available to a physician in a medical setting to do something properly were missing. So he or she had difficult decisions, but of their own making.
And a sad moment, probably, for all of us and for doctors everywhere. Dr. Stern, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, John. Pleasure talking with you.
Hi, this is Giff. I'm calling from San Francisco. The question on death penalty, it's definitely vengeance, and it is left over from our primitive frontier mentality. If most civilized countries around the world do not have the death penalty, if a country like Norway can forgive and move on after the murder of 70 campers, why can't we?
On the two men that murdered that woman in Perry, Oklahoma, these two men were executed in Oklahoma. That was justice, okay? They were human garbage. It had nothing to do with revenge. It was justice. And what seems to be always left out by the liberal media is how that woman was murdered. That needs to be mentioned along with how they were executed.
So you can join this conversation. We'd love to hear what you have to say from Freehold, New Jersey. I think the death penalty is about both vengeance and justice. I don't have a problem with that, but what I do have a problem with is whether it can be administered fairly. And I don't think that is possible. Give us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And remember, we announced it earlier this hour. If you want to nominate your book club to take part in our book club series that we're launching this summer, it's going to be the way we do books from now on. Visit us at thetakeaway.org to find out how you can get involved. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.